Hey folks, welcome to the show. Hey Sharad, how's it going, man? And before you say anything, I would like to add, today is the second time we are talking to someone who raised a bunch of money. Not really immediately. I think a year or 1.5 years post, they had the first conversation with us, but
that is still the catalyst.
That is still the catalyst. So yeah, correlation, causation. I don't want to get into that, but it gives me a great pleasure to welcome Samir Agarwal, CEO of Reffin, back to the show. Hey Samir, how's it going?
Hi, Nikhil. Hi Sharad. Going pretty well. Very happy to be back on your show.
Well, the pleasure is all ours. So a bit of color on Samir. Samir obviously runs Reffin. Reffin, as per their website, and this is part of our cutting edge research that we did 15 minutes before the episode kicked off. It's the smartest and fastest electric vehicle loans company, right? And we'll kind of break that down word by word. Samir obviously comes from a fairly long, I would say, professional background and pedigree in the domain of corporate finance and investment banking. I think Samir, you were for some time also at HSBC in yes. London, and I think for almost a decade, right?
Yeah, almost a decade.
Yes, yes. वो cutting edge research 10 मिनट पहले की थी ना, तो इसलिए वो थोड़ा सा delay था, right? But no, it's good to have you with us. And obviously you and your company has been in the news for a lot of positive reasons over the last 6 to 8 months. A fair amount of capital has come your way. I saw on Traction, Reffin is now recognized as a minicorn. I don't know like how that is classified, but heartiest congratulations. And welcome to the show. And we'd love to, you know, get into, I remember like the last time when we had spoken, you had told us about how you're looking at, you know, psychometric loan analysis to underwrite essentially EV, electric vehicle owners or operators. How far has the vision changed since then, or is it still the same and it's just at a different scale?
The vision hasn't changed. When we started, the idea was to focus on the financially excluded segment, which is basically near bottom of the pyramid, people with no credit history, people with no banking transaction, low level of education, low language skills, and so on and so forth. So to that extent, the vision is still the same. Of course, from a go-to-market perspective, we have focused on electric vehicles, on commercial electric vehicles, as the three-wheelers, but also two-wheelers and four-wheelers. So I think the vision hasn't changed. The focus has become sharper, I would say, on the electric vehicle space, because the segment, the customers are quite financially excluded, and it kind of really matches with our vision. So it's more, I would just say the vision hasn't changed. It's just more focused now.
So yeah,
just to sort of drill into the EV segment a little bit, Samir, from an underwriting logic standpoint, right, is there something unique to this asset class? Like, why is it significantly different from a CNG non-3-wheeler, let's say, right? Obviously, there are some positive ownership aspects which probably are beneficial from the ticket size standpoint, but from a strictly underwriting logic standpoint, what does EV offer that that the other probably similar asset classes don't?
Yeah, so I think, first of all, when I look at this business, I don't think this as a lending business at all. Electric vehicles are still very, very new. And there are a lot of unknown risks associated with electric vehicles. So first of all, at a very high level, I actually think of this as an ecosystem creation business. And everybody who's in the EV business is in the ecosystem creation business, because that's where we are today. There's no ecosystem around it, right? And then when you drill down further from a credit perspective, we also very clearly differentiate between customer risk and product risk.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And let me just explain both those. When we look at product risk, the reality is electric vehicles are new, technologies are new, they're untested, unproven, secondary markets are established, residual value is not established, which technology is going to scale in future is not established, the life of vehicles is not established. the performance that is being promised, whether that's being delivered over long period of time or not, still needs to be seen. Right? Things like the range and so on and so forth, battery life, all of these things need to be seen. So from that perspective, a lot of product-related issues are still unknown. And therefore, from an underwriting perspective, the first thing you have to do is actually underwrite the product itself and select the right product, the right OEM that you want to work with.
Right.
Then comes customer risk. We find a very unique thing that most of the electric vehicle adoption is coming from people who are first-time borrowers and they're first-time drivers. So it's not necessarily that people are converting from ICE to electric. It's just that people are directly leapfrogging to electric when they're becoming drivers. So drivers don't have any credit history. They don't have any driving history.
Right.
So that also becomes a unique challenge. How do you underwrite that kind of a customer segment? And how do you then ensure that this person is actually going to use that asset to generate income and, you know, be able to repay the loan, etc.? So from both product perspective and customer perspective, it is slightly different, I would say.
The reason sort of we were going there, it's very interesting that the guys who are sort of coming in are the first time asset owners and drivers, like those are sort of new into the industry. Because the reason I was sort of asking was, if you take a three-wheeler ICE kind of person who's sort of making his money through that, and you ask them, like, why don't you sort of upgrade to an electric vehicle? And they're like, oh, it's so expensive, like, I can't afford it, right? So there is a hook there for if someone's going to give them debt capital, there is an actual progression to upgrade. But this is interesting that these are all sort of first-time guys that are sort of coming into the ecosystem. So for guys who don't have any history, if you can also explain, like, what are the different loan products that are available right now?
So if I explain it in a very simple manner, our business is essentially divided into two categories because we're in the commercial vehicle space, and those two categories are defined by the end use. On the one hand, we have what is known as a low-speed three-wheeler, also popularly known as the e-rickshaw category.
Right.
Now, over here, the use case is that somebody living in a small town buys these vehicles for last-mile passenger mobility. Why? Because most small towns don't actually have last-mile passenger mobility today. Right. So in some ways, these vehicles have formed a new class of vehicles and not replacing anything necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and here the driver is an individual owner who's running an enterprise and a micro enterprise of his own, buying the vehicle and then making money out of it. Now, this driver is also able to earn in small towns, tier two, tier three towns, about 25,000 to 30,000 rupees a month, which is significantly higher than what he could make in that town doing anything else. Mm-hmm. So previously he must have been making about 8,000 to 10,000 rupees a month, and now he's making 25,000 to 30,000 rupees a month. So that's sort of one type of a loan category.
Mm-hmm.
The second is last mile delivery space. This is more city-based, e-commerce driven, where you have two-wheeler deliveries for food deliveries and parcel deliveries and things like that. But then you also have high-speed three-wheelers that are also doing last mile delivery, but of slightly larger packets. And more recently, we also have four-wheeler segments, this commercial vehicle or the mini truck category, which is also doing something similar, last mile delivery, or in some cases, mid mile delivery. Right? So those are the two sort of classifications, and each end use has a sort of a different type of vehicle as well.
So, I mean, if you like look at the first category, right? I mean, effectively there, that's probably like a very conventional loan product, right? You'll go through like a dealer distribution network, or you'll go through an OEM, and effectively you're providing capital to for purchasing the vehicle, and it also becomes like a feature to the dealer's offering, correct?
Yes.
But in category two, is it that you are going, instead of through dealers, you're going through fleet companies, right? And there, are you like the lessor who's providing the vehicle, or you are still providing a loan product?
So we are doing both.
Okay.
In this category of vehicles, the preference is to do a lease today.
So you hold these vehicles on your books?
We do.
Right.
And that's because, you know, today there is not enough confidence in the market of owning vehicles, whether by the driver operator or by the fleets as well.
Right.
Because of the product-related risk that I mentioned earlier. So leasing becomes a more natural choice today in that segment.
Right, right. Understood. And where does the, when it comes to
like the intermediary here, in the sense that you're not, it's never that you directly approach the end user. It's usually through either a dealer, a distribution network. Let me rephrase it. In both of these products, are you directly interfacing with the customer or are you piggybacking on the credibility of the intermediary?
Okay. So first of all, when I started, I said, this is all about creating an ecosystem. And therefore, we are very clear that we first need to have an agreement with the manufacturer or the OEM. Because any product-related issues have to be resolved through the manufacturer. So that's the first thing.
Right.
Then the next step in that could be either a partnership with a dealer or with an e-commerce platform or with a fleet aggregator.
Mm-hmm.
Once those two are established, then basically the end customer could be an individual or it could be a fleet owner as well. Obviously, both those come through that channel.
Right.
So a dealer channel or to a fleet aggregator channel. That's how sourcing is happening. Now, when we underwrite, obviously, we have to underwrite keeping in mind the entire ecosystem. So we need to first make sure that the OEM is good, the product is good, they're going to support any defects in the product. We also need to make sure the fleet aggregator, the e-commerce company is good.
Right.
And then we look at the end borrower. Every partnership we do has two elements. One is, does this partnership bring us scale? Second, does this partnership help us mitigate risk? Yeah. So take an example of an e-commerce company. What can the e-commerce company do to help us scale? Obviously, they have a lot of leads or a lot of drivers operating under their platform, so they can obviously give us that. But in terms of mitigation, there are a few things they can do. In e-commerce platforms, the driver churn rate is very high. So we know that these vehicles are going to keep coming back. So they need to be redeployed. So the e-commerce company also helps us with redeployment of vehicles. So that's one mitigation that happens. They also inform us when the driver is not performing well or when the driver is going to leave. So that helps in mitigating risks.
Right.
So these are the sort of, I'm just giving you some examples. At the same time, you also have to build other partnerships around this.
Hmm.
Right. So as an example, insurance. Historically, insurance in the EV segment has been extremely weak, both from a standpoint of, is there insurance available? And will that insurance then be honored, when there's a claim? Right. So we have to build insurance partnerships. Then there is telematics, embedding telematics in all the vehicles, reading the driving behavior, vehicle behavior, etc. also becomes extremely critical to understanding how these vehicles are running, because ultimately how running equals to income for the vehicles.
Right.
Then there are other partnerships, like you may want to have a partnership with an AMC provider. You have to start thinking about secondary market creation, resale of vehicles, and so on and so forth, right? So you then create a lot of these other partnerships. There's battery charging and swapping partnership as well, which is also very interesting. Especially where a driver needs to charge or swap, he's actually a very regular user of those services.
Right.
So that also becomes an excellent touch point with the customer. Equally, if you have a good arrangement with the charging provider or swapping provider, if a customer is not paying their EMIs, you can actually stop them from swapping and charging their batteries as well, which means that they have to then pay, right? So these are some of the kind of risk mitigants that you can build with different types of partners.
But how do you, I assume these become way more important in the second category of your product, right? I mean, where effectively, because you have asset ownership, you like more and more control in terms of how the asset is being taken care of through its life cycle, right? But how do you enforce it, in the sense that, is it like the vehicles are basically at set point? Like, are you operating like a fleet management company as well? Like, do you do that? Or is it effectively more a service-driven kind of an offering, that in the vicinity of where the drivers are operated, you have your partner charging stations, you have your partner, depots, and that's how you kind of get visibility?
So first of all, the beauty of all these partnerships is that none of the risk mitigants ever need to be imposed.
Right.
Right. Because actually it keeps everybody really honest.
Hmm.
Right. Because everybody has some skin in the game.
Right.
So everybody performs their duty very well.
Hmm.
Right. So if there's an issue with the vehicle, the dealer, the OEM actually, just rectify it before something else happens.
Right.
Right. So I think, So that's the first gain. So therefore, whilst we have, let's say, all systems in place to become a fleet operator, we actually don't need to activate that. So we can actually perform our duties more as a financier than as a fleet operator.
But is it because as of now, the EV ecosystem probably is not as interoperable as one would like, right? I mean, right now it's all very tied to specific OEMs, specific, you know, ancillary companies. But I'm guessing the next step in EV evolution is going to be an open ecosystem kind of a play, right?
It is true. But, you know, at the same time, you know, when all these things happen, ecosystem will mature, and when it matures, it starts becoming commoditized.
Yeah,
and then in some ways, it will start looking more and more like the ICE ecosystem that exists today. And when that happens, a lot of these things will not be needed. A lot of the risk mitigants will not be needed. So in some ways, actually, hopefully, once the transition happens, these things will become irrelevant.
Right.
And today, whilst they are relevant, because everybody is obviously and every ecosystem participant really is trying very hard to make the ecosystem successful. So everybody is contributing a lot. Right. So that's how I see it.
And you sort of touched upon telematics, right? I guess that data is used in both pricing the loan as well as the insurance. I guess those are key factors that go into both of those products.
It should, but it is not today.
Okay.
Why I say that is because EVs are new, we are at really a stage where we are in a data creation phase.
Yeah.
Right? The next phase will be utilization of data and then optimization of that data. But today it's more about creation or generation of that data. So I think now from an organizational perspective, we are there. Right? We've generated enough data. We have hundreds of millions of kilometers of data now across different geographies. And now we are starting to use that data very effectively on the ground for a variety of reasons, right? Including underwriting and pricing.
Yeah. And what is sort of your view on collections? Like how does that typically, is that a challenge for you as an organization, or is it sort of something that, you identified some of those checks and balances yourselves that you can cut them off at the swapping station if someone's defaulting, but how do you generally view and if you could even share some numbers in terms of how it's been so far, that would be actually helpful.
So collections is always challenging.
Yeah.
It's never easy.
Yeah.
No matter which organization. Let me start with numbers first.
Yeah.
Our gross NPAs today are below 2%, so about 1.7%, and net NPAs are about 0.6%.
Okay.
Right. So actually, if you think of it from that perspective, it's pretty good.
Yeah.
And that's been the story as well. For the last 3-4 years, barring obviously COVID period, but other than that, it's been like that. So I think, at a macro level, it's very, very good. At a micro level, obviously, there are a lot of challenges, especially given the kind of segment we are operating in, right? We do find a lot of vehicles, because of vehicle non-performing, you also see a lot of loans not performing.
Right.
And plus, given the customer segment, you also see a lot of delays in payments. You also see a lot of cash-based income for drivers. And then therefore, it's very difficult to digitize collections fully, so on and so forth. So you do see those issues. And I think these are broader, larger issues that we can't resolve on our own. So as an example, if you go to a very small town, tier 3 town today, people are not very used to, not in this segment, very used to, spending money through payment wallets.
Right.
Yeah. So because of that, so they're not living in the digital currency yet. Right. So you really have to make a lot of effort to send them to the bank to deposit money so you can withdraw you can deduct the EMIs from the bank account and so on and so forth. So that's a lot of effort.
Because you were talking about collections, and you have a psychometric framework. How have you seen, what's the predictability like in terms of a psychometric framework? Because that's something very proprietary that you over time with data are building, right? Is that like just one piece in the puzzle, or do you think that's a model which can be extrapolated?
No, I mean, it is a piece in the puzzle. It's not everything, obviously, because ultimately you have a lot of, you're looking at a lot of, covering a lot of product risks. Then it's a secured loan in the sense that the vehicle is hypothecated.
Right.
Right. So there are other things as well. But we do find psychometrics to be very, very relevant, especially for a customer base where 85% customers come with no password history.
Hmm.
And we've seen a very good correlation between a credit score and our psychometric scores as well.
But, you know, there's that always that statistical anomaly, right, in psychometrics, in the sense that it's, I mean, you can, like when it's a questionnaire or a survey, one can technically game it, right, one way or the other. And versus action-based data, right, I mean, the frequency at which you're topping up your mobile phone, or, you know, when do you pay rent, are there days of delay? So, I mean, that difference is always there. Do you see that a fair bit, and you need to correct for that?
Yeah, so I mean, so if I look at it, okay, I'll give you two examples. If I look at it theoretically, then as I said, there's a good correlation between psychometric score and a credit score for people who have a credit score, right? So it applies on that population quite well.
Okay.
And then therefore, by extrapolation, it should apply on the rest of the population as well. That's the first point, and that's a very theoretical point. Practically speaking, you know, I've told you about our NPA numbers. They are also very, very good given the customer segment, given that we are financing new types of vehicles, etc. So from that practical perspective as well, you know, risks are fairly low.
Right.
Now, and we have seen that the purpose of psychometrics is to determine intention, right? And we've seen, especially during COVID, we actually saw a very high level of intention from our customers.
Right.
Even though they did not have ability to repay for a few months, the intention was very high. And as soon as the ability came back, everybody started repaying. Right. So even from that perspective, I think the outcomes have been extremely good. Obviously, it is a livelihood product that we are financing. So that also plays a role. Right. It's very hard to determine this is happening because of this, this is happening because of this.
Right.
That makes sense, because it's essentially you're financing the sole, I guess in 99% cases, the sole income generating activity, right? So it sort of ties in well with that. How do you sort of think about pricing? Do you sort of work with an internal IRR kind of a threshold? Like, you know, this is sort of what we should be aiming at a loan level. Is that the thinking broadly, or is it like more, you start off talking about sort of widening the ecosystem? Is it more sort of, you know, let's sort of get our book up. Let's just look at sort of expanding our base and expanding our loan book, and we can fine tune into IRRs later. How do you sort of think about those two opposing?
So one of the consequences of having a very long professional background is that you don't want to do anything unprofitably. We're very clear. Every loan we do, we have to make a profit on that. We don't do anything just to scale. And in some ways, that might mean that we're not able to scale as fast as we potentially could.
Mm-hmm.
But also means that it makes our business a lot more sustainable. But having said that, I think on pricing, I would say it is still very, it's very elementary still. Mm-hmm. It's not like, you know, you're using a lot of analysis to come up with loan level or customer level pricing. It's more segment driven. It's more end use driven. And it's more product driven. So you actually decide your pricing upfront rather than kind of tailoring it for every customer.
Right. So there are like designated, I mean, I would assume there are internal cohorts which you...
You said, okay, this type of product, we need this much return because this is the cost of that product and this is the cost that if you borrow, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
So it's like that. And of course, deal to deal, it varies, right? So we may find that the risk of the ecosystem is slightly lower somewhere, so we may lower the pricing because of that.
Right. Does it also, does region or part of the country play a role? I mean, in the sense that you obviously go into a lot of tier 2, tier 3 locations as well. And do you see any kind of insight that comes out of it?
So that's a good question, because you know what we've tended to do in the past is wherever we found delinquencies to be higher, whatever geographies, we've just shut those geographies down. Rather than saying, let's take the price higher for those, we've just shut them down.
Right.
And that was only because there was enough opportunity to grow in other geographies.
Right.
But now, as we go into more geographies that are spread out, I think that's happening more and more. That we're starting to look at geography as well. But, you know, to be honest, what we find is choosing the right OEM and the right vehicle is the most important in this.
Mm.
Yeah, and we actually do see a very, very different performance based on who the OEM is.
But I mean, OEM, I understand from the perspective of the, you know, underlying security and stability, that I understand. How does the customer play a role?
Yeah, so now it's not because of that. It's because of after sales service primarily, and also the quality of the product.
Right.
So OEM, the dealers, do they provide after sales service? Do they provide replacement, repair work on time, etc.? I think that's really key at the moment.
Right.
And of course, initial quality of the product also helps a lot.
Is the charging and swapping ecosystem also at somewhat tied to the manufacturer or the type of OEM, or is that sort of agnostic generally?
Well, charging not so much, swapping a little bit, yes, because the vehicles need to be approved with a particular battery, right? So depending on what batteries are being used by the swapping provider, right? They will probably, each OEM would work with a few, because obviously they can't work with too many and get too many certifications and approvals.
And I mean, you talked about sort of, you know, when you're sort of looking at every loan and cost of finance, cost of debt and whatnot. So listen, clearly, I mean, you raised a bunch of money starting with equity, and now I think the most recent raise was on the debt side, which seems like a natural evolution for a lending company, right? To ultimately start underwriting on wholesale debt. Is that the view going forward, to sort of try to raise as much of debt and start underwriting on that and use just equity for sort of, you know, general growth expansion kind of thing?
So, you know, I think, okay, my personal view is that, you know, lending business can only scale on debt.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, you can't keep raising equity endlessly.
Yeah.
And also, the returns that you get on equity only get enhanced when you start raising debt. Right? So, raising debt is extremely important. Question is, how much debt you want to raise? Generally, we find raising debt of 3 to 4 times of equity is kind of optimal. Both from the standpoint of raising the money, but also to maintain your own liquidity and managing your assets and liabilities and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So, yeah. So, I mean, that's the view, 3 to 4 times leverage on equity. That's what we want to maintain.
You know, like I think it's probably more for the benefit of the listeners here, when we talk about lending or when we talk about fintechs, there are a lot of things which are going on, right? I mean, often there are lots of players who describe themselves as lenders, but they effectively are generating leads for, you know, other financing or regulated companies. There are lots of players who are cross-selling a lot of, you know, adjacent product categories as well. But you have kind of, since pretty much the earliest days, you wanted to get into lending left, right, and center, right? I mean, you have your own captive NBFC, and that is something that you plan to maintain as a focus area, or do you also look at, like, you know, third, like more of partnership type of models or more of co-lending type of models into the picture?
So at the moment, we are completely on balance sheet.
Right.
We are starting to look at off-balance sheet as well as an additional source of capital.
Hmm.
But currently, we are completely on balance sheet. I think being on balance sheet has a lot of benefits.
Hmm. But that's the more difficult journey to start with. What do you say? Or that was something that is more close to your area of expertise. That's why it was natural for you.
Oh, well, one is that for sure.
Hmm.
But, you know, when we started, you know, we started financing electric vehicles, which were very, very new.
Right.
We were looking at a customer segment that was, you know, with no credit history. We were working in tier two, tier three towns. So in some sense, for investors, both equity and debt, we were complete untouchables.
Right.
And from that perspective, it made more sense to kind of take your own risk on your own balance sheet, scale it a bit, prove it, and then start raising money.
Right.
Right. And also we were doing things like psychometrics, etc. So, you know, everything was very new. Let me just put it that way.
Right.
Right. So from that perspective, I think we would not have been able to get to where we are if we did not have our own NBFC.
Right.
And now when I look at it retrospectively, I think that was a great idea as well. Given how regulation is shaping up,
yeah.
I think ultimately everybody will have to be regulated in some way or the other. So it's good that we were able to get that out of the way earlier, because obviously now getting licenses, getting regulated is also becoming more difficult as well.
Right. Right. Is the idea here to, like, you have picked a niche, right? You've picked a certain segment. It's kind of driven by use case. It's driven by product, right? But effectively, you are doing a lot of new to credit lending. Now that there is a horizontal edge to that as well. And I don't have to tell you, tons of people want to get into it or are doing it or are claiming to do it. I don't know how well they are doing it. But what's your how do you see growth? Is the growth you think EV is deep enough to kind of, you know, keep your focus on, at least in the short to medium term? Or you do get on and off tempted, because I'm sure that whatever learnings and insights you have developed in this segment, it can be extrapolated into adjacent segments, right? As long as the customer demographic and cohort is similar.
Yeah, so I think that's a question that keeps coming up, Nikhil. My latest view on this is that, you know, if I look at EVs, electric three-wheeler sales are 55% of all three-wheeler sales in India. Electric three-wheelers have grown 100% in the last 1 year and grew 100% in the year prior to that as well. And 75-80% of electric three-wheeler sales happen only in three states.
Right.
Other states have not even touched it. Right? So, I see such a huge opportunity in EVs. And, you know, almost the entire small commercial vehicle, intercity commercial vehicle will shift to electric vehicles in the next 3-4 years. So in some sense, all the commercial vehicle space that you see is going to just transition. And we have a clear niche, we have a clear edge, but we also have a clear headway compared to anyone else.
Right.
I actually see this becoming an annual $100 billion sales business in the next few years.
Well, let me then just twist my original question a bit more. So, okay, EV is something that obviously is a fairly big ocean to, fill. Now, within EV itself, like, you have obviously focused on two-wheelers and three-wheelers. There is also the entire, you know, four-wheeler passenger segment. Then there is the e-bus segment where there is a fair bunch of government risk. Is that also something that attracts you? Because, I mean, currently, the smart thing is that you have gone in that segment where effectively when you even look at fleet cos or when you even look at consolidators, they are mostly private sector players, right? I mean, and their repayment and all that is not really, or delays is not really an issue. But do you want to also take those kind of bets?
No, we're going to focus on small commercial vehicles. Right. Two-wheelers, three-wheelers, four-wheelers. Four-wheelers, we do commercial, both mini trucks, and we'll also do taxis.
Right.
But we don't want to go into personal use today. We don't want to go into buses, large buses and trucks as well.
But like, can I ask you why? I mean, I understand why you don't want to, but I mean, what do you see? What's the gap there for you to not look at it right now?
First of all, when I look at personal mobility, there is no shortage of funds in that space.
Right.
And it's all a very, very credit history driven model. And if I go to buy a vehicle to the bank, it doesn't matter which vehicle I'm buying because they see my credit score.
Got it.
And they see my income and so on and so forth. And that's reasonably, easily, quickly accessible capital.
Right.
And cheap capital as well. So I actually don't see Refin adding too much value in that segment.
Right.
And also sort of... the underwriting that you're doing is tied to an income-generating asset for your borrower. That sort of breaks as well, right? The moment you sort of get into a personal consumption space.
And when I look at these large truck contracts, etc., I mean, those are all long-term contracts, most of them coming through government and STAs and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that's for us, really. And also the pricing over there is going to be extremely low.
Right.
You know, I don't think we'll be able to get our cost of funds that low as well.
Right.
So I would rather focus on a space where we add clear value, where there are gaps in financing in the market. And really the opportunity is very, very large. Right. And even at scale, you will still have large banks and large NBFCs operating in that space. Right, we just have to make sure we are one of those large NBFCs operating in that space when this becomes very, very big.
Just want to kind of sign off on the podcast by, getting some high level, I would say, sense about the scale that you guys are already operating at, in the sense that if you can, you know, just share a few headline numbers in terms of the size of your loan book, maybe, you know, the number of vehicles that you have underwritten, like how have things progressed on a run rate basis for you as we speak?
Okay. So far, we financed nearly 25,000 vehicles.
Right.
Across 19 states now. We are present in about 200 odd towns and cities. We have disbursed in excess of 300 crores. Our loan book is about 200 crores.
Right.
But our current run rate of origination is at about 300, 350 crores.
Right.
Yeah, so that's the scale.
Right. No, Sameer, it was, it's a delight to see how far things have gone since the last time we have spoken. We wish you all the best. And we'll obviously, we have kept track of Refin. We'll continue to do that and cheer for you on the side. No, thank you so much for your time on a slightly rainy or not rainy Friday. And thank you so much. And with that, this is Nikhil Arora. And with me, it's Sharad Tupran signing off.